Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. On this edition of the program, another installment in our ongoing Museum Confidential podcast series, which just began its third season and which is co-created by myself and Jeff Martin of Philbrook Museum. This time out, we've got a really interesting interview based on a new book just out from Dr. Seuss. That's right, Dr. Seuss, who died several years ago. There was a manuscript in progress discovered a few years back that Dr. Seuss had been working on regarding something called the Horse Museum. We learn all about that exciting new children's book focused on art and museum going on this edition of Museum Confidential. Thanks for tuning in.
Fun, fun, how can you have fun? Just sitting doing nothing when there's nothing to be done. Nothing, 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 absolutely nothing, nothing, positively, absolutely, absolutely, positively, nothing, 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 nothing to be done.
There are many kinds of museums. From the supersized Smithsonian to the childhood home of Muhammad Ali, from Bangkok to Boston, and everywhere in between. But museum goers only see part of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings, unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. Dr. Seuss died in 1991. Most of his unpublished works were soon donated to the University of California, San Diego. More than 20 years later, in 2013, while looking through a box of materials not donated, Seuss's widow Audrey Geisel discovered a folder of drawings marked Noble Failures, a nearly completed book called The Pet Shop, and a collection of sketches for a project called The Horse Museum. The Horse Museum was only about 80% finished, and contained no completed artwork. Editors at Random House set out to complete the book and hired Australian illustrator Andrew Joyner to provide the art. A true love letter to museums and a wonderful primer on art history, Dr. Seuss's Horse Museum was released a few weeks ago. We recently spoke with Andrew Joyner from his small town home in southern Australia. I guess I'd like to begin by asking you how you got involved with the project to begin with. I mean, this is a pretty massive task to take someone as legendary, of course, as Dr. Seuss, and to carry on work that was started but not finished. How did the whole relationship with this book start for you?
Well, for me, it was just through a publisher, Kathy Goldsmith, who works at Random House, she approached me with the project. Kathy actually worked with Dr. Seuss when he was alive. I think for the last 15 years of his life, she was his art director. So she worked on books like Other Places You'll Go and things like that. So she approached me first. It was with a non-disclosure agreement. So I wasn't sure what the project was. And I'd never guessed that it would be an unpublished Dr. Seuss manuscript when it came through. But yeah, so then the first thing I saw was just the actual rough that he'd left, and it was just their idea that they wanted to make it into a book, and would I be interested in illustrating it? I was pretty quick to say yes to it. I couldn't believe that this project had turned up, and I really liked the idea for it too. While it was in a very rough stage, I thought it was actually a really good idea for a book. So I thought that, you know, I could do something with it.
You mentioned to me a little while ago that in the process of making this book, you made your very first trip to the United States. You live in southern Australia. So I do wonder, what kind of global impact did Dr. Seuss have? You know, was he an important person in your life as a kid? I don't know how old you are, but, you know, when you were a kid, was Dr. Seuss omnipresent in your reading life growing up?
Yeah, that's exactly how I describe him. I'm 50 this year. I was a child in the early 70s. So Dr. Seuss was everywhere. And I still have my childhood copies of Dr. Seuss. Yeah, he was very popular in Australia growing up and still is. And I think he's pretty popular throughout the world. Like, everyone seems to know Dr. Seuss. So it was a bizarre experience to even actually see his rough drawings. Like, I've seen a bit in recent years, but, as a working illustrator, I've looked at them. But to see these rough drawings, you really get a connection to the person that was behind the work rather than just sort of thinking it as this thing, that this cultural product that's always there and always around you.
So the general gist of the story is a tour through a museum. Everything in the museum is in some way related to horses, but it's also a tour through art history of various and many kinds. And the actual artwork that's referenced in the book is the actual artwork. So you're seeing work by native artists, you're seeing work by Jackson Pollock, you're seeing work by Raphael, you're seeing all these different things. Was the decision already made to include real artworks, to reference real artworks the whole time, or when did that kind of fall into the process?
Yeah, that's how it was presented to me, and I was glad for that. I would have found it hard to do justice to, say, you know, a whole range of different art styles. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've got the skills to do that. And I think that was his idea initially. I mean, I wonder if that's why he never finished it, because it would have been really hard. Like, the thought is that he would have come up with the idea sometime in the early 1950s, and I just don't think the printing technology was there, or would have been affordable to print the book then with, like, full-color reproductions of artwork and his illustrations around it. But I really loved that idea, and I thought I could do something with it. I thought I could; it would work well with my illustrations, because there's a nice sort of balance and contrast between my work and the actual real artwork.
So the central character of the book, the kind of guide through the story, is an actual horse who is kind of serving as a docent or a guide through the museum and taking us on this journey. Did you start there with that character and kind of work your way down? You know, when you started actually saying, okay, I have to sit down, I'm going to do something that's in the spirit of Dr. Seuss, but you're not exactly copying Dr. Seuss. You're doing it in your own style, but it's more, I would call it more homage than replication. Is that character kind of how you started?
Yeah, that's exactly how it happened, really. That horse, guide, wasn't in Dr. Seuss's roughs. But there was just something about the way the text worked, which was his, you know, he'd written all the text, or most of the text. It felt like it needed that to work, and I just tried it out. I wasn't in my roughs and thought, well, I'll see what everyone thinks. And it just seemed to gel. The minute I drew that horse character, everything seemed to fall into place, and I felt like he could almost be a bit of a... Well, there was some connection between the horse character and Dr. Seuss as well, I thought, in my mind anyway. On the sort of title page, you'll see a little caricature of sort of 1950s Dr. Seuss drawing a horse in the corner, and he's dressed very similarly to the horse guide. But I was kind of like a magical reference for myself as far as, like, Dr. Seuss guiding me through the book, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Once I got that character in there, it did seem to help bring the book together. I kind of need some sense of a story in my illustrations to work. I find it very hard to just do decorative illustration. It's just something I'm not great at, or I find hard to do. And I need some sense of character and story and place, I think. And so that's what I tried to put in there with that character. And then I could build the museum and, I guess, the cast of people attending the museum around it.
So the origins of this book, as you mentioned, date back until the 1950s, and it's set, you know, basically in a drawer for decades, and it was rediscovered by Dr. Seuss's wife just several years ago. But, of course, he was working in one medium, and you're working in a very 21st century medium, meaning all of these were drawn on an iPad Pro, right, with an Apple Pencil?
Yeah. In an app called Procreate, unusual app. Oddly, that's designed by Australians too, which is nice. But
is that your kind of main place where you're doing most of your work at this stage?
I've always kind of worked digitally, I guess, but I've usually combined it with, say, hand-drawn. So like the black line work would, in the past, has been brush and ink on watercolor paper, which I then would scan and assemble in Photoshop and things like that. But for this one, and the one, another book I did on the Women's March called The Pink Hat, which was with Random House too, that was probably the first one I drew entirely on my iPad. And I found it remarkably freeing. People think it might be the opposite, but for me, I find it remarkably freeing and liberating because you can have your first sketch and then in the same space sort of go right through to your final art, which I really love. I always, when you're doing a book, you often do, like you work really hard on the roughs and you'd refine them. And then kind of when it comes to final art, you're sort of starting again. And you want to keep the energy that you had in those initial roughs when you were first getting the ideas on paper. And it's hard to replicate that when you sort of feel like you have to reproduce the work, I guess. You reproduce the same process to make the final art. But in this case, it's sort of one continuous process for me, just from, going from idea to final artwork.
How long did you have to work on the whole project from when you first got that mysterious sign this and we'll show you something cool moment to, turning in the final work? How much time did they give you to work on this project?
I had a bit of time. I actually did it. I think I finished a little bit early, which is, I must admit, unusual for me. But it took me a bit under 6 months, I think, which kids find horrifying as a bad amount of time. I mean, how could you take that long? But that's not too bad. It's quite a long book. I think I was just lucky that horse, it seemed to flow really well once I got that horse character down. I can never work out why some books, come really easily and some don't. But in this case, this one came surprisingly smoothly to me. It was hard work, but I felt like I was in control of it most of the way.
So you live in a kind of a somewhat, as you described, remote area in Australia. Have you lived there your whole life? Or I'm asking that because have you had access to art museums growing up? Did you get to go to, kind of major art museums much as a kid? Did museums play a part in your life growing up?
Well, they did because my parents really encouraged them. I did grow up in a small country town called Manham, which is on the Murray River in South Australia. A very small, like 2,000, 3,000 people, but only about an hour from the main city in our state of Adelaide, which has a lovely museum, SA Museum, and also a great art gallery. And actually, my great-great-aunts they were portraitists and miniature portraitists as well.
Like the kind where they would put like someone's hair in the back of the little portraits. Have you ever seen that? These portrait miniatures?
One of them was, and there's a few of their works, not all the miniatures, but some sort of general portraits in the actual art gallery. So, and they're not always on exhibit. So I remember going to see them and my parents always took me to exhibitions. I remember going to we'd drive interstate to Melbourne, I remember seeing a Monet exhibition there in my childhood. I remember a Pompeii exhibition touring. It was a big deal. It seemed a really big thing in your childhood when an exhibition would come, I suppose, to our city because we are a bit more remote. So certainly in the 70s and 80s, it was a kind of a major cultural event if a big exhibition toured to your city. So, I've always visited museums. Yeah, and they were a part of my childhood too.
The book serves as somewhat of a field manual for museums, how to explore museums. It's a love letter to museums in many ways, not just about, by the time you're done, you'll have a little bit of a base knowledge of the different kinds of art. But, it's how to explore a museum. There's a moment in some of the description in the back of the book where they say, the mantra that Seuss would use was, look it over, think it over, talk it over. And that's an interesting way of thinking about how to navigate a museum. People, I think, sometimes are intimidated by a museum. If it's not a place that you've spent a lot of time in, you go, okay, what do you do there? You just go in there, you look at it, Do I have to be quiet? Is it like a library where, you know, someone's going to shush me? Or can I have fun in there? Is it a place where I can kind of be free to do what I want? But I like this kind of saying, just look and think and talk. And that's pretty much everybody knows how to do that instinctually.
Yeah. And I mean, that's what appealed to me about the book too. I did think, as I said, it was a really terrific idea to enter, because the museums, as I said, were, you know, a significant memory of my childhood. And, you know, I love them now growing up, now that I'm an adult. But I did like how accessible it made it to everyone, especially children, but also adults who are not familiar with museums. I did also want to get within the artwork a connection between children creating or being inspired by what they see in the museum, because I think I think creativity is like an important and valuable for anyone's life, really. And especially for children, I wanted to see that they could see some connection between the art they're seeing and what they could possibly create.
When I was flipping through the book, one of my favorite things, the moment I got it, was I think I flipped to the page about Impressionism. And there you see from behind a very familiar character. You notice the hat and the bow tie, and you go, wait a second. Are we going to be seeing these iconic Seuss characters kind of peppered throughout the book? And that's exactly what happens. Was that always intentional, that you would see Horton or the Cat in the Hat or these fish that you've seen before kind of sprinkled throughout the pages of the book?
Yeah, well, I'm sure it wasn't Dr. Seuss's idea. I think he worked on the Cat in the Hat, came up with the Cat in the Hat probably only a few years after he did the Horse Museum sketches. And so sort of, again, it makes sense that he probably didn't get back to the Horse Museum. He kind of, his work went in that direction. Yeah, he became busy. Yeah, I did. The editor, Kathy, had that idea, I think. And she thought it would be a nice idea to have a few Zeus characters in there. And I loved it. I thought it would be a really cool way to have a little tribute to him in there. And it's a nice connection, especially for younger readers and to his other work, because it's quite different to a lot of his other books. And as you said, I didn't want to imitate his style, but I really like having some elements of his style and certainly having a little tribute to him in the characters there. But that one on the Impressionist page, but I had, for some reason, I always associate umbrellas with Impressionism, because it's, I can't remember the Renoir painting with all the umbrellas.
Yeah, of course. Like the boating, is it the boating party?
And also, that's it, yeah. I thought an umbrella, perfect. Cat in the Hat's got an umbrella. But
a parasol.
It'll sit nicely on the... A parasol, that's right, will fit work nicely with the Impressionist page.
When you're looking at the book, of course, we're seeing it, you know, we're looking at these familiar characters and things are popping up. Is there anything you can kind of tell us that would be something you kind of snuck in there that would be kind of a little Easter egg or something that would be, you know, something for you or something that would be a little inside joke or element that was kind of something that's a reference to, puts your personal stamp on the book in a way that some people may not notice, but is there regardless?
Oh, I did sneak in a little reference to, that's probably pretty obvious, Maria Abramovich with the horses present on the modern arch. because I did think, maybe I should get some reference to performance art in there. Yeah. I didn't know how to. There's a little Magritte reference on the Surrealism page, but most people, you know, Surrealism would know that with the horse dreaming of an apple.
No, it's a good point, because if the book was written in the 50s, a lot of art has happened since the 50s. And so if some of those references were there, you know, what about everything? The book was written before Andy Warhol happened, for the most part. It's good to kind of bring it into the future. And you do that also technologically. You know, there's people there with digital cameras, and there are little bits of technology in there to kind of bring us into... You know, it has that classic feel that could be timeless, but you say, this is also reflecting the world we're in now. This is not like the golden age look at the past when, you know, everything was there. And you also obviously made an important decision to make the book feel very inclusive in terms of representation, which obviously would be different if this book had been written in the 1950s. You know, the way the crowds of children look, and it's much more of a diverse group of people. I'm sure that was intentional as well.
Yeah, but I mean, I feel that. I mean, that's what a museum looks like when you walk through it. I mean, if you walk through, I mean, the last museums I've been to are as a tourist. So there's lots of people in there, like say the Uffizi in Florence. There's a lot of people there, and the Met I went to in New York, and there was big crowds. But that's what it feels like. I even watched that Frederick Wiseman film, The National Gallery. Yeah, I just wanted to, that was when I first started working on it, and just to get a sense of what a group of people in the museum would look like. I mean, mine are sort of repeated characters, but it's kind of like you want to put, I know I don't draw realistically at all, but you want to put some sense of what actual life and actual museums are like in there. And so I think that's diversity is like an important way of showing, you know, reflecting what actual, the actual world is like. And it also helps, I think, every child see themselves in that museum,
yeah,
which I thought was important, as, you know, something that's accessible and open to them.
Yeah, and that's important. We deal with that a lot in the museum world, saying, you know, it's not only important to see yourself amongst the patrons of the museum, but also in the art that you see on the wall. And, you know, so the choices in here are great as well.
Today's episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by museum-scented candles. Ever walk into a museum and think, geez, I love the way it smells in here? Wouldn't it be great to take that museum smell home with you? Well, guess what, friends? Now you can. Museum-scented candles are made with only the highest quality wax and wicks hand-selected from over 150 varieties to thereby ensure the best burn possible. Light it up, close your eyes, kick back, breathe deep. You can almost see the artwork hanging on your very own walls. And while you'd never be able to afford our art, these wonderful wax creations carry a price point that is quite reasonable. Museum-scented candles, just for the smell of it.
You mentioned Dr. Seuss having a big impact on your life growing up. Imagine that, you know, you have one book to take with you. This is that standard scenario of I'm sending you to a deserted island and you get to take one Seuss book with you, okay? There are so many to choose from. And certainly his, I would say, more social books, you know, kind of looking at some issues that are present in the world today, of course, like The Lorax would probably be the one that sticks out the most in terms of, you know, ecological issues. But, you know, what's that one Seuss book that is your favorite? Now, I'll give you a chance to separate it out a little bit, because you can have both your favorite, which might be a personal thing and you have a connection to, but also what you think is kind of the best.
Well, personal, it's hard to go past the ones that you loved as a kid. I did really love The Cat in the Hat as a child. And so I'd probably go with that. Yeah, I still enjoyed reading that when I read it to my own children. They're teenagers now, but I really enjoyed that. I think if I was alone on a desert island, I think I'd go over places you'll go just for
some hope.
I think I'd find it in a way comforting.
It could backfire, though, and be quite depressing if you can't get off that island, though. You'd be careful.
I know, but there's something about you can tell, you get a sense that you definitely get a sense that it was his last book. That's kind of remarkable that he could so perfectly nail it for your last book. And it works as a sort of final book. It's an amazing farewell book, I think.
So he died in 1991, right? He died in 91. So we're getting close to 30 years pretty soon without Dr. Seuss around. And he did do, you know, he was working pretty much, you know, up to the end. I think a lot of people don't realize beyond maybe the 12, 15, 20 books they know. There's a lot of Seuss material out there. Did you go back and kind of look at stuff that had happened maybe since you had grown up? You know, he was producing material that you weren't familiar with. Did you kind of find a few things that say, hey, I didn't really know about this. This was kind of a little bit of a diamond in the rough that's out there. Did you find any of those lesser known Seuss books?
I sort of went back to, because he did it in the 50s, I went back to some older stuff, and I didn't work directly with Dr. Seuss Enterprises, who look after all his work, but they, Susan Brand, who's the president of that company, suggested looking at some of his earlier style, which has more of a pencil look, like Horton Hatches the Egg, and I think it's Bartholomew Cubbins.
Or like And to Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street, I think, which might have been his first
book.
Even
these very first books, just to look at some of his earlier style, it has a sort of softer feel to it. So I looked at some of those, and it was interesting looking at the artwork there. It's amazing how I went to the University of California in San Diego, where all of Seuss's material is kept. And you look at his early work and his later work, and there's amazing continuity of style. And, you know, some of his political cartoons and some of the things like that, they look immediately recognisable as Dr. Seuss. And it seems amazing. It's sort of like he arrived fully formed. I mean, you see some of this stuff from when he's like, the very early 20s or probably late teens, and it's obviously not as refined and has a slightly different look. But it wasn't long until he had this very particular style and way of looking at the world that it was immediately recognisable. And that's what really struck me. Without any art training or anything, he just sort of had this style and he stuck with it. He perfected it or stuck with it, and it was just him, really.
It's almost like cultivated in his DNA,
Yeah, he's one of those people that, it was just part of him. It's just how he drew, and it just came out of him like that.
Not unlike a Picasso or someone whose style is just immediately, almost inseparable from the person.
Yeah. That's why I was nervous about the idea when I first looked at it, they'd want me to imitate Dr. Seuss's style, because I find that very hard to do. But they said, no. That's not what they wanted. So that was good in that regard.
Yeah. Well, I really enjoyed the book. I think it is going to be, of course, a huge success in the museum world. I think we're all very excited about it. You know, this was sitting in a drawer unknown to the world for decades. But now that it's here, it feels like an essential part of the Seuss canon and also just something to have there. So thanks for doing it. I appreciate that.
Oh, thank you. That's very nice. My hope was that museums would really embrace it, and I hope that they would enjoy it and find it, useful for their own work. Yeah.
I got the horse right here, the name is Paul Revere, and here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, this guy says the horse can do.
The popular television show Mr. Ed ran from January 1961 to February 1966 for a total of 143 episodes, all black and white. The plot was this: an architect named Wilbur gets into all sorts of misadventures with his precocious talking horse, the aforementioned Mr. Ed. There's a large gravestone in Tahlequah, Oklahoma that appears to be the final resting place of Mr. Ed. But is it? According to the popular website Atlas Obscura, there's more to the story. Quote, most visitors and locals believe the horse in the grave is Bamboo Harvester, the Palomino horse born in 1949 who played Mr. Ed on television, then retired to the Oklahoma farm where the 5-foot granite marker now stands. He reportedly became sick in 1968 and was euthanized before being laid to rest near a cherry tree in 1970. But Alan Young, who played Wilbur Post, the only person to whom Mr. Ed would speak on the show, says that Harvester actually died following a shot of tranquilizer in California and was cremated, his ashes spread around by his trainer, Lester Hilton. Young says the horse buried in Oklahoma was a different Palomino horse named Pumpkin, who died in 1979. Pumpkin was used for publicity shots for the show and took up the mantle of Mr. Ed after Harvester died, but never played the role on television. A third story has Harvester dying in California and being buried in Oklahoma. End quote.
Hello, I'm Mr. Ed. A horse is a horse, of course, of course, and no one can talk to a horse, of course. That is, of course, unless the horse is the famous Mr. Ed.
That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org, or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.